As a young boy in middle school in the Netherlands, I was taught that the anonymous medieval Dutch animal epic Van den Vossen Reinaarde, or Reinaard de Fox, en français ce sont ridicule, Reinaard, Reinaard. Anyway, Reinaard de Fox of 1260 was not just one of the finest works of Dutch literature, but that it was by far the best of the medieval animal epics. The Dutch Van den Vossen Reinaarde is a long narrative poem of a few thousand lines of verse that tells the adventures of a sly fox that manages every time it is summoned to court in order to be judged for his crimes to outwit his many and more powerful enemies in the animal kingdom. Not only the lion, who is the king of the animal world, kings are easily duped, but also such animals as the bear and the wolf that are his closest competitors. The work is written in a highly accessible style, the plot is interesting and moves forward quickly, and the story is told with wit and irreverent humor. It well has earned its status as a Dutch classic. The rediscovery of the earliest medieval versions of this epic poem in the first half of the 19th century, its acquisition by the Belgian National Library, and its subsequent publication all played a major role in the burgeoning nationalism of those times, even more so in the Flemish part of Belgium than in the Netherlands. As our textbooks introducing Van den Vossen Reinaarde very much stress the originality of the Dutch work, I was highly disappointed later on to learn that a Dutch animal epic was a relatively late work and very much indebted to the numerous earlier French language epics on the adventure of the fox, even though we were reassured that none of them reached the same literary quality as the Dutch work. Still later, my national pride was soothed to some extent when I learned that the French animal epics were very much dependent on a large Latin epic named Isengrimus, on the wolf, which most likely had been composed in the middle of the 12th century in the city of Gand. So in the Flemish, that is the Dutch-speaking part of modern-day Belgium, at the leading center of Dutch language culture at the time. Ever since that time, I have been interested in animal epics. Not so much in animal stories. Almost every culture in the world seems to have a rich tradition of animal tales. But in many cultures, these tales belong first of all to the tradition of oral literature. It's only in some literary traditions that such animal tales were picked up at an early date by authors in the literary tradition. In Greek antiquity, for instance, we witness the emergence of a body of fables, in part of which animals as animals talk and interact with each other and with human beings. This body of fables would later be adapted into Latin and from there into the various languages of Europe, providing many of the stock characters and plot lines of the later medieval animal epics. Greek literature also has given us the Batrachomyomachia, or the Battle of the Frogs and the Mice, a short parody of the Homeric epics in which mice and frogs fight each other for dear life. In this respect, it's a far cry from the Persian animal epic, Mantek At-Tayr, The Conference of the Birds, by the 12th century poet Farid ud-Din Attar, which allegorizes the search for mystical wisdom in a long animal epic which serves as the frame for many entertaining stories and fables. South Asia is, of course, another region of the world which is well known for its rich literature of animal tales. One line of development was the adaptation of these tales in the Indian tradition of fable writing, which culminated in the compilation of the Panchatantra. This work has enjoyed a remarkable distribution in the last two millennia, as it was translated not only in the languages of Southeast Asia, but also into Persian and Arabic, and in this way also reached medieval Europe. While some of the Pancha Tantra tales eventually would make it into China, the work has, to the best of my knowledge, never been translated into Chinese in pre-modern times. There may have been many reasons for this absence of a Chinese translation, but most likely the major reason must have been the traditional abhorrence of fiction in elite Chinese literature. Chinese literary theoreticians have insisted from the very beginning of Chinese literary criticism that literature should give expression to the truths, either the truths of the situation as observed by the author in historiography, or the truths of the emotions incited by the observed situation in expressive genres such as poetry. For over 2,000 years, the fables and fantasies of the Zhuangzi have continued to perplex Chinese readers and critics, and the work was never imitated in later ages. It is, of course, difficult to imagine a more conspicuous example of blatant fiction than talking animals. In South Asia, animal tales were also popular, and this is the second line of development, with the compilers of the Jataka tales on the earlier lives of the Buddha. And the canonical status of these tales within Buddhism did ensure their translation into Chinese. But it is again remarkable to see how limited the impact of this body of translations has been on Chinese literature at large. Chinese preferences, I believe, are clearly indicated by the very popular Bai Yu Jing, or the Sutra of 100 Fables, in which all stories are anecdotes featuring humans. No talking animals are encountered in this collection. Anyone who takes the trouble to look through a Chinese anthology of classical Chinese fables will encounter the same phenomenon. Chinese fables, almost without exception, feature talking humans and dumb animals. Talking animals are indeed a very rare phenomenon. The well-established negative attitude towards blatant fiction in the Chinese tradition therefore seems to doom any search for a Chinese animal epic. But the situation is not as bleak as it seems. First of all, we can tout the Xiuji, or Journey to the West, as an animal epic with Chinese characteristics. At least two of the main characters in the sprawling narrative, Sun Wukong and Zhu Bajie, have clear animal characteristics. Sun's facial features are very much those of a monkey, and those of Zhu Bajie betray his nature as a pig. Many aspects of the behavior too tell of their animal nature, but much more conspicuously on stage than in the novel. In the novel, Sun Wukong and Zhu Bajie have been far more humanized in their appearance than the main characters in the medieval European animal epics. They walk on two legs and they are properly dressed as human beings. In general, it would appear that the Chinese authors would prefer their animals to take on full human shape before they allow them to interact with human beings. One only has to think of the many tales of the marvelous from the Tang Dynasty or from Pusung Ling's Liao Jai Ji, in which a bewitching variety of vixen and other animals manifest themselves as seductive maidens. A full discussion of the animal epic in China would, of course, have to take into account these materials, but within the limited scope of this talk, I would like to focus on a number of stories in which talking animals interact with other animals and human beings very much as animals. We can locate such stories and the multiple literary adaptations once we turn from elite literature to popular literature. Once we do so, we will discover that, as in the case of Van der Vos Renade, the plot of such animal tales often is based on the standardized procedure of a law case. Today, I would like to take a closer look at two such cases, the case of Swallow versus Sparrow and the case of Mouse versus cat. So first, swallow versus sparrow. The discovery of the treasure trove of manuscripts in the bricked-up library cave in Dunhuang in 1900 has made us aware that the literature of the Tang and Five Dynasties was much broader in scope in terms of genres and subjects than scholars had long expected. I am afraid, however, that the results of the research on these Pianwen texts has not yet been fully integrated into the narrative of Chinese literary history. This may well be due to the fact that now for over 100 years, the study of Dunhuang materials has been a highly specialized branch of scholarship, which also in the People's Republic only really got underway after the end of the Cultural Revolution. While most of the Pianwen texts belong to a number of prosimetric narrative genres, some of these texts are classified as sufu, or popular rhapsodies, perhaps better translated as popular declamation pieces. In the traditional Chinese genre classification, the fu or rhapsody, or rhyme prose as it was called earlier, is usually classified with wen or prose because it was not in the form of a song, a shi. But from a European perspective, it is at least awkward to treat the fu as prose, as fu respect strict rules of prosody and rhyme. Since the pioneering selection of translations by Bertrand Watson, Western sinologists have tended to treat the fu as a genre of poetry in their renditions. Whereas the regular fu range from small lyric pieces to grand epidactic compositions, the sufu tend to be narrative works that draw for their diction not only on the refined classical language, but also on the contemporary spoken idiom. The major work in the genre of popular declamation pieces, or sufu, is an adaptation of almost epic proportion of the court case of the swallow and the sparrow, entitled Yan Zi Fu, the Rhapsody on the Swallow. This title immediately alerts us to the fact that in early Chinese animal tales, the preferred characters are all birds. From an early day, the Chinese tradition has perceived a homology between the hierarchy of human society and the hierarchy in the kingdom of birds. The rites of Zhou contain the line that an official in a formal meeting held a bird of a particular species to indicate his rank, which must have made the court of the kings of Zhou something like a zoo. And in the Zhuozhuan, year 17 of Zhuozhou, the Viscount of Tan narrates how in a mythic past, during the reign of his distant ancestor Xiao Hao, all bureaucratic positions were named after birds. Among the Dunhuang texts, one finds a seven-syllable song that describes the ranks and position of each bird at the court of the phoenix. This short text is commonly known by its abbreviated title as the Bai Niao Ming, the names of or the titles of the 100 birds. The text is an ornithological minefield. While most of the birds listed can be identified more or less easily, other songbirds are apparently designated by popular and local names of that time that makes identification very difficult. The basic story of the Rhapsody of the Swallow is pretty simple. When the swallow, a migrating bird, returns in spring to his old nest, he discovers it has been occupied by a sparrow. The sparrow refuses to budge and gives the swallow a beating, whereupon the swallow appeals for justice to the king of the birds, the phoenix. The phoenix is convinced by his complaint and has the sparrow summoned to his court by a wren, in the translation of Arthur Whaley, or perhaps more convincingly, a shrike. And when the sparrow arrives at court, he is berated by the phoenix and thrown in jail, where his wife comes to berate him at length. Following a thorough questioning at a second session, the phoenix is about to condemn the sparrow, but eventually does not punish him because the sparrow claims great service to the state. And when the sparrow and the swallow together have a drink to make up, they are both berated by a swan, the sparrow for his criminal behavior, and the swallow for his litigiousness, whereupon the swallow and sparrow turn against the swan together. This Ienzefu, or this Rhapsody of the Swallow, must have been quite popular at Tunghuang, as several complete and partial copies have been preserved, 8 in total, which is a pretty high number. That popularity is well deserved. It is written with great gusto and effectively parodies all aspects of judicial procedure. It would appear that the Ienzefu is the earliest extensive account of a court case from Chinese literature. The Chinese scholar Chu Yongchao has compared the description of the judicial procedures with other available information from the Tang on the conduct of law cases and has concluded that Swallow, Sparrow, and Phoenix follow the procedures in detail. The swallow lodges a written complaint accusing the sparrow of threat and robbery. And the sparrow, too, is summoned by a note from the court. Once the phoenix has first interrogated the sparrow, he entrusts the further questioning to the head clerk in conformity with the fourfold division of responsibility in the Tang bureaucracy, and the head clerk uses a written questionnaire. The use of torture and imprisonment fits the norms. In this text, in many texts it doesn't. And the sparrow is indeed allowed to redeem his crime with a payment in money because his status as upper pillar of the state. Among the Tunghuang manuscripts, one encounters yet a second text, also entitled Rhapsody of the Sparrow or Ienzefu. But this text has only been preserved in a single manuscript copy. Whereas the first Ienzefu is divided by a switch of rhyme in a number of stanzas, all of unequal lengths, this second Ienzefu is written in stanzas of 8 lines of 5-syllable verse. In this somewhat shorter version, the story has been simplified. Now, much more space is given to the dispute between the swallow and the sparrow when the swallow discovers that the sparrow has occupied his nest. The court case is reduced to a single session at which the swallow and the sparrow continue their dispute. In this version, the sparrow defends his position by arguing that he is a tax-paying permanent resident who therefore deserves the protection of the court, whereas the swallow is only a wanderer, an illegal immigrant. The phoenix eventually restores the nest to the swallow and orders them to be good friends. If the first Ienzefu very much depended on its satire of judicial procedure, the second Ienzefu seems to find its strength in its parody of judicial language. Together, the two adaptations of the same story demonstrate the scope of variation in terms of form and context that is possible when two different authors deal with the same materials. Now, the two texts on the court case of the swallow and the sparrow have shared in the upsurge in Tunghuang studies since the 1980s and have now been repeatedly edited and annotated. They also have been the subject of numerous articles. Both Ienzefu are also available in English translations, even though they could well do with new translations. The long version was translated long ago by Arthur Whaley in his entertaining book of what is it, stories from, text and stories from Tung Huang, and Yang Xinyi and Gladys Yang did a rhymed version of the other version a long time ago in Chinese literature. But let's turn to another court case which is less well known in sinological circles, that of the cat and the mouse. As China has always been an agricultural society from its earliest beginnings, it has had to deal with mice and rats. The Chinese term shu not only refers to mice and rats, but to all small furry animals in general from its inception. Already in the Book of Odes, as we know, big rat is used metaphorically for rapacious officials. And throughout later centuries, thieving mice and rats continuously appear in Chinese literature. We already encountered a number of such creatures in our discussion of the Pan last week. One of the three fables collected by Liu Zhongyuan in his Three Admonitions features a gentleman who allowed rats the run of his house because he had been born in the year of the rat. As a result, everything in the house is damaged by these creatures. But when he has to move away and his successor moves in, the latter quickly has the rats killed off. Needless to say, in a fable authored by a typical elite author, the rats in the fable may make a lot of noise, but they don't say a single word. The belief that rats, if old enough, could transform themselves into bats inspired Liu Zhongyuan's contemporary Pai Juyi to the following fable in the shape of a quatrain. A rat achieved transcendence, soared on its new wings. All other rodents, seeing this, were filled with jealousy. They did not know that halfway on its way to heaven, it would be caught and eaten by some raptor like a hawk. But again, no, none of these rodents says a word. So, whereas mice and rats are very old in the Chinese tradition, the domestic cat only appears at a much later date and probably is a Buddhist contribution to Chinese civilization. Some later stories credited the introduction of the domestic cat to the famous Tang Dynasty monk Xuanzang. Good mouses were greatly appreciated, and early encyclopedias provide detailed instructions on how to make sure that one's cat will do his or her duty. But many cats apparently distinguish themselves, then as well as now, by their laziness. The first vernacular tale to confront cats and rat is the well-known story of the five rats creating havoc in the eastern capital, which also features Judge Pa. This story, which first appears in the last years of the 16th century in writing, belongs to the more common type of Chinese animal tales in which animals take on human shape. In this case, the animals even have the rats, even have the temerity to take on the identity of specific individuals. One rat becomes a student, the second an official, the third, oh blasphemy, the emperor, the fourth, the empress dowager, and the fifth, eventually, Judge Pao himself. The real Judge Pao then has to travel through the underworld and heaven in order to identify the shape-shifting creatures and to borrow the Buddha's cat to do away with them. Initially, the monks try to convince the Buddha that he should not allow them to him to borrow the cat, but they try to pass off the Buddha's lion to Judge Pao, and of course a lion is of no use in catching mice. So Judge Pao has to go back and fetch the real cat. This story has been studied in detail many years ago by André Lévy. It circulated in many shapes, as an individual novel, as a chapter in The 100 Cases of Judge Pau, in the Lungtokong'an, and in many varieties of prosimetric storytelling. In the 19th and 20th century, however, the most visible tale of mouse and cat was the legend of their wedding. The wedding procession of the mice, taking the mouse bride to the house of her groom, the cat, was a favorite subject of New Year prints and of paper cuts. The parents of the bride had decided on the cat as a son-in-law. One always encounters typos while reading, because they wanted to marry their daughter to the most powerful person in the world. And because the cat was mightier than the mice, who were mightier than the wall, that was mightier than the wind, that was mightier than the cloud, that was mightier than the sun, they had decided on the cat. The grateful groom reciprocated by ensuring the safety of his new wife by stuffing her in his belly. Popular as this story may have been all over China, it hardly, if ever, was written up into a ballad before recent years. The story that was written up in various genres of popular literature was the tale of the court case of the mouse and the rat, but that was hardly, if ever, the subject of visual media. The tale of the court case of the mouse and the rat, Lao Shu Kao Mao, seems to have been widely circulated from the 19th century onward, when it attracted the attention of two earlier English translators of Chinese popular literature, who each produced a rhymed version of the text at their disposal. The basic elements of this tale that are shared by all versions I have seen are that a mouse that has been killed by a cat, once it has arrived in the underworld, appeals for justice to King Yama. King Yama is filled with indignation upon hearing the sorry story of the mouse, and summons the cat. When the cat appears before the underworld bench, it is extensively berated by King Yama, but the cat counters by listing all the damages that are caused by rats and mice. King Yama thereupon immediately changes his tune and sends the cat back to Earth with the explicit permission to catch and kill any kind of vermin. As is well known, the Chinese underworld has a very bureaucratic structure. Since the 9th and 10th century, it was widely believed that the souls of the deceased had to appear before the 10 judges of the underworld. In the underworld, clerks maintained exhaustive registers of the good deeds and evil behavior of every person. And if the written record failed, all crimes would be revealed if the soul looked into the mirror of sins, or the word I prefer as translation, the karma scope. But as humans could be reborn as animals, animals too, upon their deaths, could appeal to the judges of the underworld and complain about the sufferings they had experienced, especially those at the hand of humans. Stories of animals laying plain before King Yama have a long history in China. In some of the illustrations of the Sutra of the Ten Kings, studied by Percy Thaiser, found at Tunghuang, we already see a number of animals approaching the bench, each holding their written complaint in their mouths. And from the Yuan Dynasty, we have a number of Sanchu songs written in the voice of slaughtered animals, such as buffalo and sheep, appealing to King Yama and clamoring for justice. Especially the accusation of the buffalo against its human masters remained a popular topic in later times. But whereas the buffalo has good reasons to complain about his human masters who work him to death while alive and slaughter him when his strength gives out, the accusation of the little mouse against the cat has much less ground. In its simplest form, an adaptation of this tale may consist of simply the text of the statement of the accusation of the mouse, the defense statement of the cat, and the final judgment of King Yam. And I will read to you one such version, which is now in Taiwan, but collected in collections of Taiwanese popular literature, but which is actually written in classical Chinese, pure and simple, the standard language for this kind of judicial documents. And so the first, so what we have is actually a file of accusation, counterstatement, and judgment. And the first text is the accusation of the mouse. I, the person lodging this accusation, am surnamed Old. My personal name is Mouse, and my style name is Rat. This concerns a case of murder without guilt, followed by the chewing and devouring of the corpse. A family of mice has been settled in a hole in the earth in the Eastern Wall Lane, and I'm now 99 years old. Originally, we were registered in heaven as the Rat, and later our old name was Market Day. The Rat was in charge of the 12 cyclical years of birth, so buffalo and horse ceded first place to the Rat, and dragon and tiger accepted the Rat as the leader. But when unexpectedly huge waters rose in rebellion, Heavenly King Li banished us to the common dust. We were deeply grateful to His Majesty the Emperor for his great grace of every stone of grain that was entered into the government granaries. 3 cups were deducted as grain for rats. We will hear in a moment whether that was true. But nowadays, those most vicious and most depraved people tightly seal up the granaries with chalk, and so we mice have nothing to eat by night or day. Alas, during broad daylight, we can only hide ourselves to the east and make ourselves scarce to the west, and only when dusk has arrived do we dare go out and enter the home of people. All along the road, we search for some leftover rice and some discarded food. In each and every place, we look for some chicken bones and fish heads. We do so only to still our hunger and pass the days, hoping to survive for our remaining days. And because we are afraid that the owner may notice us, we stretch our neck and retract our head with flustered gall and fearful mind. Who could have known that when I had not yet gone for a few paces, disaster would strike? On the wall, I ran into an evil cat. Its body resembled wolf and tiger. Its eyes resembled bronze bells. When it saw me, this mouse, it showed off its tiger and leopard-like might, displayed its power like thunder and lightning. Bearing its fangs and stretching its claws, it slowly approached with raised tail. I, this mouse, was so scared that my body turned soft to soft cotton, and I was covered in cold sweat. My heart was terrified, my gall was flustered, and I couldn't move my legs anymore. That evil cat jumped forward and grabbed me with his left paw, his evil words earnest and sincere. He carried me hither and thither to dispel his gloom and amuse himself. At first he grasped me one moment to release me the next, but later the play became reality. Suddenly we were seen by the dog and he rushed over to save me, but who would have thought that that evil cat would come up with a plan? Clenching me between his teeth, he jumped on the roof in one leap, and there he sat down at ease and chewed me fine and slowly devoured me from head to tail. It is my honest opinion that I did not violate any rule or break any law. How will my unjust death be avenged? Moreover, the owner of the cat treats him with great favor and indulgence. He provides him with food, and whether it may be vegetarian or animal, it always is enough to fill his belly. But on top of that, he has to eat me the mount as dessert. That evil cat enjoys 100 kinds of pleasures. During daytime, he is free to go wherever he wants, and at night he sleeps on the blankets of his master. When depressed, he stretches his waist and displays its claws. When happy, he rolls on the floor and jumps about. In wintertime, he warms himself in front of the stove. In summertime, he enjoys the cool below the bamboo. In my opinion, that evil cat enjoys 100 kinds of pleasure. Is there anything that does not please his heart? For as mice, the most galling thing is that we have to hide ourselves to the east and make ourselves scarce in the west, and that we have to spend our days in constant fear. At all times, we just sit quietly in our hole, and we have no enmity with the cat at all. Humbly, I beseech your honor, King Yama, to scrutinize the injustice I have suffered, and to take pity on me, this little mouse, for my gruesome death. I request that a dog may be summoned to appear in court, so it may be interrogated and testify to the facts. If you will redress this injustice and execute the evil cat, we little mice will be indebted to you from generation to generation. If one word is a lie in this statement of facts, I will be happy to be condemned for false accusation. Accused criminal, tabby cat. Witness, house dog. And then the counter accusation comes from the tabby cat. Once you are accused, you will submit a counter statement. I, the one lodging this counter accusation, am surnamed Tabby, and my name is Cat. This concerns a case of patrolling the place by night and day at the order of my owner. We cats were originally registered as domiciled in the western heavens, but I was brought to the eastern capital by the Tang monk, where I followed him in the hall and listened to his sermons, read the sutras, and recited the name of the Buddha, without any evil or vicious intention. This case originated because in the wall, in the lane by the wall, live old mice that time and again act as crooks. So I am dispatched to the houses of people to make an arrest. In the past, the only intention was to scare them away. But alas, these damned mice commit hundreds and thousands kinds of crime. During daytime, they enjoy leisure and pleasure in their hole, but at nighttime, they rob and steal from east and west. In groups and crowds, they all squeak. With friends and buddies, they create a ruckus, and everywhere they prowl about. When stealing the 5 grains, they make no distinction between rich and poor. And when they chew up people's clothes, they don't distinguish between old and new. They gnaw through the most precious baskets and boxes, and destroy the most important official documents. When they enter a study, all books meet with bad luck. And when they enter a closet, the clothes suffer destruction. There are old mice, mountain mice, field mice, barbarian mice, sable mice, water rats, pine rats, countryside rats, silver rats, ash rats, white mice, brown rats, rock rats, and chaff rats. They have different surnames but share the same name, a shoe in all cases. And each of and every one of them lacks virtue. In hills and fields, they make their holes, and in forest trees, they also make their nests. It is only old mouse who lives in the houses of men and whose character is most vicious. Irrespective of how important things may be, he destroys everything with his gnawing. When he enters a Buddha hall, he tears and damages the text of the sutras. And when he goes into a granary, he calls for his wife and his brood. And when they have taken the grain back home, old and young will all feast on it. When they enter a kitchen, they move the bowls and manipulate the plates. Stealing oil and sauce, they break and destroy jugs and bottles. They steal the oil from the lamp in front of the Buddha, and time and again they destroy by their gnawing boxes and baskets. Because of the hundreds of plans and cunning tricks, the owner is moved to rage in his heart. Cleansing his jaws and gnashing his teeth, he will loudly curse him, filled with fury. The ancient saying is, one feeds a cat to catch mice. One keeps a dog to guard against thieves. Whenever I run into a mouse, I catch it alive. At the order of my master, I patrol the place by day and night because vicious old mouse recognizes neither law nor heaven. And then we get an almost identical closing formula. Humbly I beseech you, Lord Yama, to hang up high your bright mirror and to establish the true facts of the case so you may act on behalf of the cat and exterminate those damned mice. By removing this harm for the people of the world, they will not need to rely on the cat patrolling the place by day and night. Every family will be moved to gratitude. Every house will bathe in your good grace. Submitted as counter-accusation, accused criminal, old mouse. And then the decision of Court Yama. Concerning the accuser, the accused, and the witness, the whole bunch of damned felons. We find through our investigation that old mouse commits myriads of evils, and on top of that dares make a false accusation of a crime. He will forever be locked up in the Fengtu hell. Old mouse will be escorted to the earth prison below the dark mountain to suffer for his crimes in the vats of boiling oil, in the sauce and between the steel millstones below the mountains. When he has served out his punishment, he will forever be locked up in the Fengtu hell as a prisoner. And on this day of this verdict, he will be put on transport. Tabby Cat arrested him for the common good, as was only proper. He will be gifted with one piece of red silk, two golden flowers, and three cups of wine from our stores. These will be released and gifted to him in person, so he may, for generations on end, continue to arrest these vermin. He is otherwise without guilt. But the witness, house dog, is punished for his false testimony. His crime deserves the death penalty. But I take into consideration that he did not know the original facts, 30 strokes of the heavy bamboo. The whole party is released. They will all abide by this decision. And then, as only part which is not a court document, there's a final concluding poem. The mouse is the most criminal creature in the world of man. How can he be allowed to breed without end in house and wall? He may be as cunning as can be and have 1,000 dirty tricks. In the end, he'll fall into the great sea, attacked by hand and claw. Now, most of the adaptations of this court case of mouse and cat do not start so suddenly in medias res with the mouse laying plaint before King Yama. For instance, the plaint of the mouse as performed in Yangzhou Qingqu starts with a long discussion between a mouse and a rat in which they proudly found their lineage and then describe their descriptive powers in great detail. You find this detail of rat and mouse founding their lineage in more text. And in some modern versions, they will even refer to the fact they are well acquainted with Walt Disney. Mickey Mouse made it all the way, not only to Disneyland Paris, but also to Wenzhou, where I found that version. But Rat and Mouse continue their discussion in the Yangzhou version as follows. Our only problem is our landlord, a mean-spirited sycophant. He will give his presents to others, but he never gives them to us. He does not treat us properly, so we pester him so he's never at ease. We have our fights in the Buddha shrine, so the candlesticks will fall over. We have our horse races on the beams, raising our arms and displaying our troops. And we take a leak on the mosquito curtain above the bed, dripping till he's wet all over. The wax candles in the lantern shade, we gnaw them through to their very center. The paintings on paper by famous masters, we tear them all to pieces. His clothes and silks all suffer a plague. In the boxes for fruits, we open a back door so we can go in and out at will, eating as tigers, gobbling like wolves. Whether it rains or snows, we are not concerned at all. Cotton floss and dry straw are sufficient to ward off the cold. Come to think of it, which animal in the world can even come near to us? Can even come near to a mouse? However, the very moment the brave rodents are surprised by the cat, they are immediately filled with fear and desperately try to make their escape. The rat manages to get away, but the little mouse is swallowed whole. In the songs that have been recorded in recent years in Shantung, the mice are so desperate that they even decide to organize into an army to make war on the cat. And the impressive lineup of this army is described in great detail and with epic grandeur, reminding one of Homer's Batrachomyomachia. In a second watch, when the moon stood in the east, our little mouse returned home to mobilize the troops. He beat the general's drum, which boomed and boomed. He fired the general's cannon, which resounded repeatedly. Old and young, three armies strong, stood to east and west. Wearing helmets, clad in armor, they were quite impressive. The bronze helmets were provided with straps. The chainmail armor brilliantly blinded your eyes. The darts with their flags were stuck in their back. The heart-protecting mirrors hung before their breast. Around their waist, a silk belt twisted into nine parts. The armor's commander-in-chief had its messengers, and a flagpole with a huge banner stood in the middle. The young soldiers marched in the front, and behind them followed a battalion of widows. They had poles, they had swinging hammers, lances, sabers, swords, and spears in many layers. You'd like to know how many mice there were? It was impossible to count those roaring crowds. Those advanced in years brought up the rear. Those healthy and strong formed the vanguard. Waving flags, beating drums, they marched forward. Their battle cries rose to the skies without ending. But again, as soon as the cat appears, the militant mice once again scatter in all directions, and many of them end up in the stomach of their enemy. And again, the appeal to King Yama by the mouse only results in the reaffirmation by that authority of the right and duty of the cat to hunt mice. Despite these additions to the tale, however, none of these narrative accounts of the case of mouse versus cat follows up on the suggestion of the mutual accusations of cat and mouse in mentioning the dog as a witness and increasing the number of kinds of animals into the tale. The most detailed account of the case of mouse versus cat that I have encountered so far is the precious scroll of the mouse, Lao Shu Bao Juan, that circulates in Western Council. This text starts out with a retelling of the tale of the five rats creating havoc in the Eastern capital to explain the enmity between mice and cats. It continues with the description of the death of one mouse because of rat poison and follows this with the account of the filial attempts of its sons, Midnight Boy and Grain Grabber, to take revenge for the murder of their father. But they soon become victims of a cat, whereon their souls appeal to King Yama. The little mice died in a cruel way and wanted to revenge this injustice. In King Yama's court, they accused the cat in a written statement in these terms. He first had killed our father, and then we went out looking for his remains. He also devoured the two of us who didn't provide him with any motivation. So we accuse that evil cat of an exceptional abuse of power. Not once but twice, not twice but thrice, it has brutally killed the like of us. Our grandmother is 86. Who will now wait on her? Our own dear mother and little siblings, who will take care of them? We have suffered a disaster that has completely wiped out our whole family. It has killed everyone in our home. No one has escaped with his life. As in many other adaptations of the tale, an outraged King Yama orders the arrest of the cat. King Yama accepted the accusation and read it in a meticulous manner. In that accusation, the crimes of the cat were clearly described in great detail. So he said, "Little mouse, you should stay here and for the moment take your rest." And then thundered, "You little cat, you acted in an outrageous manner." He promptly ordered his ghostly stalwarts to quickly get out their iron chains, grab and arrest that little cat, and bring it in for an interrogation. When the cat is arrested, he only follows the constables after he has a litigation master compose his defense. And armed with this document, he appears in court. Confronting each other in front of King Yama, the mice once again paint an extended picture of utter innocence in detailing their activities. But the cat counters with a long and detailed catalog of their sins that start out with a description of the havoc created in the eastern capital by the five rats. The precious scroll then continues as follows for its conclusion. "Now tell that when King Yama had heard this account by the cat, he was overcome by a towering rage and he loudly shouted, 'You damned mice, how brazen you are in your disregard for authority. You created havoc in the eastern capital of the Song Empress, harassing and harming the common people, but claiming the role of innocent victim, you were the first to lodge an accusation.' And he ordered his underlings, 'Give these mice 40 strokes with the cudgel and send them back to the world of light so they can serve as food for the cat. Take the cat to the world of light so it can be a good friend of the common people and, not shirking from arduous toil, will free them of this pest of mice.' And when he had pronounced this sentence, he left the hall. Indeed, having received this order, the ghost took the cat back to the world of light. The mice then were also sent back to serve the cat forever as its food." Upon his return to Earth, the cat ponders the impossibility of ever finishing off all rodents, while the mice regret their foolishness in rashly lodging an accusation because it resulted in a verdict that condemns them to serve as food to the cat for all eternity. Now, my conclusion. Extended animal tales written up into prosimatic narratives of verse ballads are certainly not limited to the two stories I've discussed above. Texts that confront insects or other small critters, founding their qualities to each other, are still an item in many genres of prosimetric storytelling all over China. The formality of a funeral also apparently makes it a favorite subject for animal tales. George Carter Stent, who also did a translation of the case of mice versus cat, provides, for instance, a very successful rhymed rendition of a text on a funeral of a critic in which all animals participate. What these scenes have in common is the ritual formality of the event. A court case is with its prescribed procedure, a funeral with its prescribed procedure, and Also, for instance, a marriage with its prescribed procedure are apparently attractive topics for animal tales. My own interest in these materials has two sides. First of all, there is the comparative element. While China has its animal epics, it's also clear that such texts occupy a very marginal position in Chinese literary tradition. Many of the most important texts of animal epics with Chinese characteristics have only come to light through accidental discoveries or have only been recently published as part of the effort to document China's intangible cultural heritage. The marginal position of these materials, even within popular literature, tells us much about the nature of Chinese literature in comparison with other literary traditions. The second aspect of my interest in these materials concerns translation. Over the years, I have translated a number of these texts into my native Dutch, and in more recent years, I've also prepared some English translations, which I hope to publish in the near future. I've been stimulated to translate these texts because I find them original and witty. There seems to be a tendency in Chinese scholarship, in China and abroad, to equate erudition and high literacy with literary quality. But these texts prove, to my mind, that authors who did not pass the examinations or who did not attend university are equally capable of literary talent. Translation forces one to read carefully. And working on my translations, I have often been impressed by the inventiveness and the subtlety, the gusto and humor of these anonymous authors. I enjoy doing these translations, and I can only hope that my readers will enjoy reading them too. Thank you very much.